May it please the court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant, Terry Moore. When Sergeant Malone seized Mr. Moore and his companion, she had only a general description fitting a suspect that fit the description of a substantial portion of the population. She lacked any specific or particular facts linking Mr. Moore, his companion, or anyone else to any criminal activity. And in fact, at the suppression hearing, she testified that as far as any particular information other than race, she didn't have anything except that they were the only ones out there. One June night around 11:15.
Excuse me, let me stop you because it's kind of on my mind right
sure.
at the moment. How far away from the location of the whatever uprising there was Mr. Moore at the time that the officer stopped him?
He was about 1,000 feet away, and I think the actually there's an exhibit attached to the brief that shows a map that was introduced at trial, and he and his companion were walking down the street. What happened was after she received some general information about the melee that was occurring, she headed in the direction of the melee and continued past it 1,000 feet. She saw these two men standing on the right-hand side of the road, walking on the right-hand side of the road. And from behind, she testified that her attention was drawn to them because one man was fidgeting with his waistband, even though she was looking at him from behind. So she thought he might be the stabbing victim that they had information on. The other man had his hands in his pockets, even though she couldn't remember if it was a jacket pocket or pants pocket. She thought he might be the shooter. Neither of those facts, by the way, did she put in her police report. When she saw the two men, she then drove by them, observed them for only 5 seconds, spun her car around, activated her flashing lights, drove against traffic, and blocked the men with their car. She testified that at that point she knew neither of the men was a stabbing victim. But she got out of the car and asked the men to come towards her, and for officer safety, asked them to show her their hands. Now, the state argues that was not a seizure. And they argue that beyond that, there was some more fidgeting, and then she told the men to put their hands on the car, and that's when the seizure occurred.
Is that material to the outcome of the case?
No, it's not. And the trial court focused significantly on that issue, and if this court wants to focus primarily on the reasonable suspicion, because the state says nothing occurred between the two incidents that really affects the analysis, I can focus on that. But what the lower court did do was erroneously focus on what is the plain language of Jones versus State, and said that in footnote 78, this court left some wiggle room to say a seizure doesn't occur when it's done for officer safety. And in fact, what the trial court did was completely misunderstand this court's holding in Jones. This court first addressed whether there was reasonable suspicion to stop the individual and concluded that there was not. Then, at the end of that analysis, in a footnote, it addressed what would have been the seizure. I suspect that it was in the footnote because the court really didn't need to address the issue for the outcome.
If the officer observed what she believed was a victim of a stabbing, she could do everything she did, right, in terms of wheeling around, turning on the lights, and approaching them and making them stop under the community caretaker doctrine, couldn't she?
Not in this case, Your Honor, because she didn't have any reasonable suspicion that that was the case. What she had was general information that there were 10 to 15 black people, male and female, about 1,000 feet away from these men. There was an assault, there was a stabbing, there was a shooting, and that the person who fled may have a stab wound. She didn't have any information with respect to age, height, weight, facial features, whether it was a male or a female, what direction they were heading, whether the shooter was with the stabbing victim. When she saw the individual that she testified to that was fidgeting, again, she was from behind. She testified it was very dark, and his hands were at his waist. She testified that after she spun her car around, shone her lights on them, before she got out of the car, She could see clearly that neither of them was a stabbing victim. So even if the court determines that that wasn't a stop, as soon as she gets out of the car and asks to see their hand, she seizes them then and clearly knew that neither one of them was a stabbing victim.
What was the reasonable and articulable suspicion on which the result here rested?
Well, the court relied on obviously what the state had cited, and these were general facts about the incident, that it was a high crime area, that she was responding to calls about criminal activity that was in the area. And again, she focused on the fidgeting and the hands in the pocket. The problem with what the court relied on and what the state relied on.
Well, okay, just taking all those facts together,
sure.
You know, how do you crystallize that, I mean, in a sentence into what the reasonable and articulable suspicion was? Suspicion of what?
Sure. She had reasonable suspicion, we acknowledge, that there was criminal activity taking place. What she did not have was reasonable suspicion linking Mr. Moore or his companion to that criminal activity, because the only information she had was general. Again, they were in a high crime area, granted. She stopped the two first black males that she saw. She didn't even know if they were males that were the suspects. She didn't even know how old they were, their height or their weight. And what's interesting is looking at the dispatch log, before she stopped him, there was a radio dispatch that came through indicating that one of the witnesses had a description of the suspect or knew who it was. And yet she didn't take the opportunity to try to get that additional information.
Did the time and distance fit in terms of the time it would take someone to walk from the scene of the incident to where she found them?
Well, that's a good question, Your Honor, and I've tried to figure that out myself. I believe it does. It was like 3 minutes. Looking at the map and the scale of the map, though, it appears, and of course this will be for the court to determine, that it was actually further than 1,000 feet using the scale. But the officer testified to 1,000 feet, and accepting that to be the case, yes, it is possible. And in fact, after she arrested him, they later said that, well, they heard the shots in the area, so they were leaving the area. And they were not running. They were not out of breath when she saw them. They didn't attempt to flee. When she spun the car around to block them, they didn't attempt to flee. She had a couple choices here. She could have, because there was no immediate concern that they were taking off, could have called on the radio dispatch and said, do you have a description of the suspect? She could have driven by them with her window down and asked them questions. Of course, that may be unsafe, but officers have done that in the past. But she cannot then stop them and then rely on the fact that she calls them to her car to see their hands and say, well, I was in danger for my safety. And
what can she do? Let's assume that, hypothetically, that there's a description, exact description, of two people who witnessed, did not participate in the crime, but witnessed the incident that happened earlier. And what can she do in approaching them?
Well, in that case, it probably would be less dangerous for her to drive past them, roll her window down, and ask them questions. In fact, that's what the officers did in Ross versus State, and this court concluded that it was not a seizure in that case.
Is that the only way it can be done?
She could have parked her car behind them and asked them if they'd come talk to her, if she could talk to them. I think what the problem was here is she put on her flashing lights. That's a significant point. She blocked their path. That's also significant. She could have, you know, there are a number of ways she could have done it. She could have parked the car behind them, and again, the circumstances would have dictated whether it was a seizure or not. The fact that she immediately asked to see their hands has to be a seizure, because if we think about the typical, you're under arrest, you know, put your hands up, that's exactly why you put your hands up, is so the officers know that they're safe at that particular time. And between that time and the time that she told them to put their hands on the car, apparently there was some fidgeting, but the state has said that doesn't add to the reasonable suspicion. Thus, whether the seizure occurred when she first approached them or when she told them to put their hands on the car, there's still a lack of reasonable suspicion, and they argue that there was reasonable suspicion. So even if the court were to conclude that her spinning the car around, et cetera, was appropriate, when she told them to show her hands, or the best case scenario for the state, when she told them to put their hands on the car, she seized them. And she, at that time, knew that neither of them was the stabbing suspect, victim. And at that time, she couldn't recall at the hearing whether the man had his hands in his jacket pocket or pants pocket, leading to the question of whether or not the individual may have, in fact, had a weapon.
So under your view of the case, once she did what, once she spun the car around, turned on the flashing lights, had them stop, and then concluded that they were not victims of any criminal activity, she should have been gotten back in her car and driven off?
Yes. Or at the very least, if the court's not going to conclude that that it was a seizure, she could have asked them, can I talk to you, and not had them put their hands out immediately. But this court recently in Bradley versus State agreed with the state's concession in that case when the police car drove up behind a parked car and put his flashing lights on, that that was in fact a seizure. And that's consistent with a significant number of jurisdictions, including in New York in Swift versus State, which is almost identical to this case in that there was a police car that parked about 10 feet in front of two pedestrians. And the court concluded that at the time of night of the encounter, the officer's conduct before he approached the petitioner, the blocking of the petitioner's path with a police cruiser, headlights shining on the petitioner, the officer's testimony was conducting an investigatory field stop, allows us to conclude that this was a seizure. And even in cases like Chesternut, where there's dicta, they seem to indicate that a significant factor, and sometimes dispositive factor, is when they put their flashing lights on to stop someone or block their path, that is a seizure.
Let's assume that it is a seizure, and let's further assume hypothetically that it's justified under the community caretaker doctrine. Just assume that, whatever the set of facts. How does a Terry search interplay with the community caretaker doctrine? If you're on the scene to render assistance to someone that you think is injured or in need of aid, when can or how does Terry interrelate to that?
Well, under the caretaker doctrine, that gives them the ability to stop the person, purportedly stop or approach the person and ask them, are you okay, what have you. That doesn't give them the right to frisk the person unless, just like when a normal stop, they feel like they are in danger and there's officer safety. If they are allowed to be there lawfully, there's still another set, another analysis they have to go through. They have to determine if they have fear for safety. If there's, you know, I would concede that fiddling with one's waistband may be consistent with someone having a gun based on officer's experience. Okay, would that give her the right to frisk? Yes, if and only if she was lawfully there, whether it's under the caretaker doctrine, whether it's under any other reason. And here it's important to note that that never entered this officer's mind or the prosecutors discussing the caretaker doctrine at all. And as I indicated, when she looked at them and had her lights on them before she got out of the car, she said that that it was dispelled. Any suspicion she had was dispelled that there was a stabbing victim there.
Let me ask the kind of fundamental question from my perspective, at least, and that is, we know there's some sort of trouble with an assault with perhaps gunfire and stabbing and so forth. And we also know that this police officer is at the scene 1,000 feet away a few minutes later and sees two people who also are African American, although that doesn't mean that they were involved. But aren't those three facts enough to say, you know, this is not just stopping somebody walking down the street. This is stopping two people very close to the scene of some sort of criminal activity, and that is enough, and they're walking away from where that criminal activity took place. That is enough to have an articulable suspicion that these two people could have been involved. Maybe not, but this is not just picking you out because you're black and you happen to be on the street tonight. Mm-hmm. It's very much related in time and space to a criminal event.
I would disagree that would provide reasonable suspicion. First, I would note a quote from the officer in responding to questioning As far as any particular information other than race, I didn't have anything except that they were the only ones out there. So in her mind, it was race and they were the only ones out there. However, the location and race alone do not provide reasonable suspicion that they were linked to any criminal activity. Race is a factor. There's no issue with that here. But she needed more. She needed some additional information. There are a couple cases in People versus Brown, which is a New York case. Within 3 minutes of a robbery, the police less than two blocks away saw two black males, and the only information he had at that time of the suspect was that they were black males. That officer cut across the northbound traffic and stopped in front of the defendants and frisked them. That court concluded that the fact that these were black men and they were near the area and in that case looked over their shoulder and act nervous was not enough.
Let me ask you this. Suppose counterfactually that instead of being 1,000 feet of the away from the reported crime scene, they were only 50 feet or even 25 feet. Would that change the analysis?
It would significantly help the officer. I think that she would still need to have some additional information. The problem in this particular case is that there was additional information available to her and she didn't seek it. And while the location is a factor, could be a factor in a totality of the circumstances, if she had specific information about the individuals.
Right, but I gather from your answer then that even if these defendant and his companion were right at the reported crime scene, that it wouldn't make any difference.
Well, if they were right at the crime scene, there are several officers there, and she would have gotten more specific information. So there were witnesses there to provide her with that information, officers.
So all right. But I mean, there's some zone, from the radius of a
right.
circle with, with the crime scene in the middle, that
right.
is in the center, where had the defendant been found there, there would have been a reasonable and articulable suspicion.
I can't argue that location and the closer it is to the scene wouldn't help the police. One thing to keep in mind here also is that the officer testified that this was a very densely populated area. So when they're 1,000 feet away down a road where it looks like he would, it wasn't in the woods or nearby that way, that takes away from the reasonable suspicion in that case.
You're well into your rebuttal time if you want to save it.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Deputy Attorney General Gregory Smith on behalf of the State. Your Honor, this is not a case that requires this Court to overrule its decision in Jones in order to affirm the decision of the Superior Court. The State has acknowledged for purposes of this argument that, has assumed, I should say, for purposes of this argument, that a seizure took place at the time when Sergeant Lone turned around her marked police car and activated her emergency equipment. And so essentially the important question based on that that assumption of that's when the seizure took place is, what did Sergeant Malone know and when did she know it in advance of seeing Mr. Moore and his companion? At approximately 11:15, Sergeant Malone was on routine patrol in the vicinity of 273 and 13. When she heard radio traffic, beginning with calls that there was a melee going on in the Spencer Park townhomes in the Cathy Court, a street in that area, Cathy Court. These were non-anonymous phone calls, and that's in the record at A30, involving approximately 15 black males and females. And specifically in that information, she was aware that an individual had apparently been stabbed, and the victim of that stabbing had left the scene. She's then driving down 13 at that point with her emergency equipment on. As she gets to, I guess, the 1340 split, that area where you would enter get onto Old Forge Road to get into that area. She's then turned off her emergency equipment at that time. She's heard now from Sergeant Mary Devine, who is another Newcastle County police officer, a supervisor, who's already arrived on the scene. And from Sergeant Devine, she's heard shots fired. So now she has the non-anonymous reports from residents describing an actual crime that's take place involving a stabbing and disorderly conduct. And now on top of that, she has information from a fellow police officer on the scene of shots fired. She knows that there are already some officers who are on Cathy Court, so she tries to go to an area in that development where officers are not located. And that's when she encounters, approximately 4 minutes after the report from Sergeant Devine, that's when she encounters Mr. Moore and his companion, approximately 1,000 feet away, 4 minutes after that last report. So that's the information that she has at that time. And as she passes them, specifically, she also sees where they are. Again, this is June 18, so it's a reasonably warm time of the year. Mr. Moore is wearing shorts.
Okay,
so
what is the reasonable and articulable suspicion that she had at the point of the seizure, given the information that you just recited to her?
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly, these are people who do fit the general description of people involved in the melee, and their proximity both in distance and in time to that scene, along with the positioning of their hands. And that's something that she does see before she turns around and activates her emergency equipment. So for Mr. Moore, she sees him, he has shorts on, his hands at his waistband, and
the suspicion is that they are somehow involved in the criminal activity that was reported. Is that the answer?
Yes. And at that point, Your Honor, and this is at A26, she did articulate, she's not sure whether that could be a victim or a suspect. She has not determined in her mind, oh, I know this is the suspect. It could also be a victim. And in fact, it could also just be a witness to all of this. But she does see, I'm sorry, returning to Your Honor's question, Mr. Moore is there in shorts with his hands at his waistband. Mr. Moore's companion has his hands in pockets of either a sweater, sweatshirt or a jacket. I'm not precisely sure at this moment. I don't think that matters, but hands within pockets. So she's not able to see any of their hands, and certainly we have the temporal and distance proximity of actual crimes taking place.
And okay, you said it could also be a witness. What's the authority to seize a witness?
Your Honor, I would want to say the police officer wouldn't be seizing the witness, but that would be part of the community caretaker doctrine, an investigative role to speak with a witness. And I guess I'd like to juxtapose this with Jones, because in Jones, the only facts that were made available to, I believe, then Patrolman Echeverria were a high crime area, nighttime.
Well, before you do that, I gather that the critical facts are against the background of this reported criminal activity. Number one, the defendant and his companion were only 1,000 feet away from the scene. Number two, both were black, and the reported perpetrators were black. And three, both men had their hands hidden.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely.
That's it, right?
Yes. If we did not have the calls from both the non-anonymous neighbors reporting and from an officer on the scene, certainly there would not be.
That makes the report credible. That goes to the credibility of the report. Let's assume that the report is credible. We still have the problem of whether this policewoman had a reasonable basis to suspect that these two men that she saw 1,000 feet away with their hands not visible were somehow involved.
Yes, Your Honor. And I guess if I may go back to juxtaposing this with with Jones. In Jones, there's only a high crime area, a nighttime event, and an anonymous tip. And that anonymous tip is not, in fact, of a crime. It's just saying, quote, a suspicious black male wearing a blue coat in front of 98 Carlin Drive in February. Well, that's not a crime. Here, we know that there had been a crime, you know, within the last 4 minutes of this incident. And this is not an officer simply engaging in, let me just stop and harass black people. That's not what this is. This is, she's doing her duty investigating a crime. In fact, it would be a dereliction of her duty if she saw these folks and then said, well, you know, I'll just keep going about my business. I mean, it's entirely appropriate for Sergeant Malone.
But the response to your comment, the comment you just made, I gather would be, sure, of course she had a duty to investigate the crime, but the way she should have investigated it would have been to drive the car alongside these two men and say, can I talk to you?
Your Honor, that's one possible way of doing it. If I may, Your Honor, certainly because it's nighttime.
Well, wait a second. Are you saying that police have some authority if they're investigating a crime to seize people?
To stop and interact with people.
Well, wait, but you've already acknowledged, the state has acknowledged that there was a seizure here, not just a stop and interact.
The state has assumed.
All right. Yes. Whatever. So for purposes of what we're discussing here today, there was a seizure. Is it the state's position that police officers have some prerogative to seize people as long as it's part of an investigation of a crime?
Your Honor, I guess the no is the short answer to that.
Okay, well, and let's move on a little bit. What's your response to the New York case that opposing counsel described as being very close in fact to this one, with the robbery having just occurred and the people being seen near the scene of the crime and so forth?
Your Honor, the state's first position is that it's not controlling on this
right.
court. If I may deal with the activation of the lights as part of this incident, Your Honor, I don't mean to not answer the question.
Go ahead.
Activating the lights at night, there can be multiple reasons for activation of the lights, and that can be to make sure that no other cars run into the police car or run into the people with whom she's speaking.
Again, you're absolutely right, but for purposes of our argument, the state is taking the position, which I think is sensible, that there was a seizure. So although a police car can activate, a police officer can activate the lights in the car and the sirens even, for reasons having nothing to do with seizing someone, in this case, they did contribute to the situation being a seizure, and the state is not contesting that, correct?
Correct.
So what we're dealing with is, was there a valid basis for a seizure? Seizure, not was there a valid basis for turning on the lights and sirens?
Yes, Your Honor, and I guess I'll just come back to the facts as I related earlier. The reports of the crimes, the distance, and the time, as well as the placement of the hands.
And the race of the two.
Yes, it certainly is consistent with the reports that came in, that it was a group of 15 black males and females.
And from those facts, your position, the state's position, is that the police officer had a basis for a reasonable and articulable suspicion that these two men were involved, either victims of or involved somehow in the criminal activity that had been reported.
Yes, Your Honor.
But But it comes down to three facts. One is proximity to the crime scene.
Yes, Your Honor.
Racial features and the location of the hands.
Yes, Your Honor, and time as well.
And time.
Can I ask you this? Opposing counsel made something of a point, maybe she didn't intend to, but it seemed that way, something of a point of the fact that the police officer did not avail herself of additional information about the crime that was available, that, you know, she could have called in to whoever it is that first told her that there was a crime that had taken place or done other things to get a better handle on who she might be looking for and whether these particular people might fit any description of the perpetrators or the victims or whatever. Does the state have any view as to whether there, in establishing a reasonable basis for seizing someone, you should take into account whether more information was or was not readily available?
It's the state's position, no, Your Honor. It's just the information that was, in fact, available to the officer at that time. Certainly this was a dynamic situation, and just in the amount of time that counsel has been speaking with Your Honors, that's effectively the amount of time from when the report first came in to the time that the arrest, the pat-down, finding the gun is actually completed. And that's a tremendous amount of stuff is happening in a short period of time. I don't have my finger on the record site for this, Your Honor, but Sergeant Malone testified how much radio traffic there was, and that she there's only so much communication you can do, that even once she had made the arrest, it still took, I believe, maybe another 2 minutes to be able to get through based on the volume of radio traffic to get additional officers to assist her.
Okay, but even if, let's assume for purposes of discussion, that all the officer had to do was push a button on her intercom or whatever, and at the other end, immediately, there would be somebody who could say, we're looking for, a 6-foot-tall black man with a beard. And then she could look at the people on the street and say, ooh, neither one of them is 6 feet tall with a beard, so these people are not the people we're looking for. But let's assume that she could have obtained additional specific information immediately, not that it was hard to get through and all that. Would that bear upon the analysis of whether she had a reasonable, articulable suspicion?
No, Your Honor, it should not.
Immediately prior to the pat-down that revealed the object in the pocket, what are the, from your perspective, the reasonable, articulable facts which justify a suspicion that officer safety was implicated, that she could search for a weapon?
Certainly, Your Honor, knowing that a shot had been fired and that there was a stabbing. So she was aware of potentially two different kinds of weapons having recently been involved in this vicinity. And then the fact where they're keeping their hands and that she's outnumbered 2-1. Those three things would be what goes into the officer safety calculus at that point. And I guess let me back up and add to that then as well the high crime area and the hour of the day, approximately 11:20 at that point p.m.
Now, at the time of the search, doing a community caretaker focus temporarily, the time of the search, had the reason for any community caretaker function dissipated?
At the time of the search, Your Honor, I believe Sergeant Malone's testimony, at least, was that she no longer believed by the time of the pat-down that one of these individuals was a stabbing victim. That, I believe, is her testimony in the record. That said, that still doesn't mean that somebody can't be a witness to the crime. I guess that may be separate from the community
Williams,
caretaker.
We said the community caretaker doctrine addresses the situation from which an experienced officer would suspect that a citizen is in need of help or is in peril. Then the officer has the right to stop and investigate. It doesn't talk about being a witness.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's why I tried to say that wasn't. If the court has no additional questions, then the state would pray that this court affirm the decision of the Superior Court. Thank you.
Thank you.
To address the last point quickly, on A33, defense counsel asks the officer, just to clarify, though, once you had turned around and were facing the two head-on, it doesn't sound like you had any suspicion of one being a stab victim at that point, though. You had kind of dispelled that. The answer is yes. So when she turned the car around at that point, that was dispelled. So there can be no caretaker function here. With respect to Justice Berger's questioning as to the availability of additional information, I would generally say no, we can't second-guess the officers. However, what she had available to her at that time was a hunch, allowing her to conduct investigation, allowing her to follow up and get more information. In Lopez-Vasquez versus State, for example, the state had a significant amount of information as to criminal activity taking place, and the defendant was seen with the target of their investigation outside a building. They went in the building at the same time. The defendant actually left the back of the building when they finally went in to do the search. The police stopped him, and this court concluded that that wasn't sufficient to link him to the criminal activity. And it was a hunch and allowed them to conduct more investigation, which is what she should have done in this particular case. And another important quote from the officer when asked about the fidgeting and the hands in the pocket, she said, I was going to stop them anyway, and that's at A34. And that's interesting given the fact that neither of those facts were in her original police report. She was going to stop them anyway. Thank you. Well, I'm sorry.
That raises a question. That seems like such a an unusual answer that I would have expected some follow-up to that. Was there a follow-up to, you know, what do you mean you were going to stop them anyway?
I think it was in the context of she had already said that it was primarily because of the other general factors that the state has listed, which was reasonable suspicion of a crime, but not of these two men.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement and take a brief recess.
Please rise.